The title was always intended to be Return of the Jedi, but we made the film under the codename Revenge of the Jedi. Unfortunately, what happened is Fox started promoting the film before we could tell them not to use the title. We were lucky that they didn't start promoting the film under the title Blue Harvest, because we were also using that as a bogus title.
This doesn't seem to make any sense, though. The film was already operating under the codename Blue Harvest. Why would it have two different codenames? More importantly, it makes even less sense to call it Revenge of the Jedi to deceive the media. No one would doubt that a film called Revenge of the Jedi was the next Star Wars film. In fact, Lucasfilm itself had been promoting the film as such since May 1980. Lucas had been referring to it in private as Revenge ever since 1979, and his own script drafts bore this name, as did call sheets and other internal Lucasfilm documents. Everyone knew that it was the next Star Wars picture, which was why Blue Harvest was created. Production supervisor Jim Bloom explains that it was he who suggested they change the title to Blue Harvest, due to issues related to being overcharged on equipment fees. Just as well, a one-word difference was hardly anything exciting, and all it did was confuse fans and retailers. Paramount Studios certainly must have been. Their latest Star Trek picture was to be called The Vengeance of Khan, but when it was announced in 1980 that Star Wars III would be called Revenge of the Jedi, the film was renamed The Wrath of Khan to avoid confusion. Dale Pollack reported a similarly weird explanation, this one dating back to the time of the film's release in 1983. Although Revenge of the Jedi was the first title announced, Lucas always intended for the film to be called Return of the Jedi. He just didn't want to give away the plot. The switch came no less than 6 months before Jedi's release and cost several thousand dollars. What seems to have happened is that Lucas did indeed suggest Return as a possible title, but at Kazanjian's recommendation changed it to Revenge. It wasn't intended as a fake or temporary title. It was Lucas's genuine choice. This was in 1979, when the focus of Star Wars III was to be Luke and the Rebels fighting back after their defeat in Empire Strikes Back. However, as the actual script to Revenge of the Jedi began to be written, it eventually evolved to being about Luke redeeming Darth Vader, and thus the vengeance angle of the script was no longer present, and made Lucas realize that an aggressive motive like revenge would not even be a Jedi trait in the first place. Later drafts experimented with the original Return variation, but Lucas didn't commit to it, as revenge continued to be used in official documents and private conversations. As the release date began drawing nearer, however, Lucas began to have second thoughts. Steve Sansweet noted this in Lucasfilm's The Vault. It's clear there had been an internal debate raging, with producer Howard Kazanjian favoring what he felt was the stronger revenge, and George Lucas slowly coming to the conclusion that the word just didn't fit the movie. Viewers realized this long before the film was released, as when Howard Kazanjian gave a Revenge of the Jedi presentation at Ireland's Octocon in 1982, fans apparently criticized him that Jedi don't take revenge. In November 1982, Lucasfilm formally launched a market research report on whether audiences would respond better to Return or Revenge of the Jedi. The report concluded that, while younger respondents are somewhat excited by the term revenge, many moviegoers over 30 are turned off by its violent connotations. The implications of the term revenge do not fit the good guy Jedi image, as portrayed in the first two installments of the Star Wars saga. In conclusion, if the saga is to continue with the good versus evil theme it has delivered to date, Return rather than Revenge might be more effective in communicating this message. The film was rushed to completion, ending up on time and on budget. In fact, its release date was bumped ahead by 2 days to make it coincide with the release date of the original film. It had been 6 years since Star Wars was introduced to the world, and cinema was in the midst of a reversal of the upheaval that had occurred in 1969. as executives began to take back film as a broad form of commercialism. Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer were starting their careers, while Arnold Schwarzenegger, Sylvester Stallone, and Eddie Murphy were breaking out into superstardom, and the box office was being dominated by films such as Friday the 13th Part 3, Flashdance, Superman 3, and Staying Alive, a far cry from the days of American Graffiti, Mean Streets, and The Conversation. The next year would bring hits such as Beverly Hills Cop, Karate Kid, Police Academy, Purple Rain, and Terminator. As Star Wars bowed out, the 80s arrived in all its glory. Finally, on May 25, 1983, the Star Wars trilogy came to an end. Chapter 8. Endings. There was an air of relief as the film neared completion. The tiring saga was finally coming to a close. As Lucas reflected on what was to come next in his life, he knew one thing was for sure. It would not be more Star Wars films. Dale Pollack reported in early 1983, "The most logical thing for George Lucas to do is direct more Star Wars movies, which is precisely what he won't do. He only completed the first trilogy, he says, because I had a slight compulsion to finish the story. Jedi may be the last film George Lucas really cares about. He has little emotional investment in future Indiana Jones movies, or even in the next Star Wars trilogy, should it ever be made. Nothing will match the all-consuming sense of mission that he brought to the first three films." Lucas himself had finally had enough of the series. Its hectic schedule had been all-consuming and taken over his entire life for the past 6 years. Dale Pollack reported on Lucas's frustrations. "There are times when Lucas is ready to chuck the whole thing. Walking across Elstree Studios during the filming of Jedi, he fantasizes selling Star Wars, the concepts, the characters, and the plots for all six films. What if the inheritor of the Star Wars legacy screwed up and made a lousy movie? Wouldn't that be painful?" "Not at all," Lucas says. "I've always thought I did a bad job. This might make me feel better." Later, he admits that the fantasy of dumping Star Wars is an escape valve, giving him the illusion he can always back out. "Emotionally, it would be very hard to do," he admits. Comments like these reflect Lucas's bitterness at the time. He had gone through much personal grief in the course of making the films. The small-town experimental filmmaker had grown into the biggest movie mogul on the planet, and the Lucasfilm kingdom consumed his every waking hour.
"I see my daughter a couple hours a night, maybe on Sundays if I'm lucky," he said at the time. "And I'm always real tired and cranky and feeling like, gee, I should be doing something else. I sort of speed through everything. It's been very hard on Marcia living with someone who is constantly in agony, uptight and worried, off in Neverland."
As Lucas admitted to Time in May 1983, just as Return of the Jedi achieved completion, the hectic and stressful making of the Star Wars trilogy had taken a personal toll on him.
"The sacrifice I've made for Star Wars may have been greater than I wanted. After Graffiti, Star Wars could have gone in the toilet and it wouldn't have mattered financially. It's an interesting choice I made, and now I'm burned out. In fact, I was burned out a couple of years ago, and I've been going on momentum ever since. Star Wars has grabbed my life and taken it over against my will. Now I've got to get my life back again, before it's too late."
The price of success could be seen in his personal life as well. As filmmakers will often bemoan, balancing a professional and personal life is a very difficult task. Lucas had been working around the clock since getting married in 1969, and becoming the head of an empire did not make things easier. He told Starlog in 1981,
"When I was in film school, it was 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That was all I thought about and did. I didn't do anything else. Then when I started working professionally and got married, I had to work all the time in order to just get anywhere. And I didn't have a vacation until I finished my first film and went to Europe. I had a couple of bucks in the bank, and I said, it's now or never. My wife had been bugging me. I'd been at it for 4 or 5 years straight, and she said, you can't go on like this. That was in 1973. I didn't have another vacation until 1977, when I went to Hawaii after Star Wars. My wife likes to have vacations. She doesn't like not to be able to go anywhere year in and year out. She'd like to be able to say, look, let's take off for 2 or 3 weeks and just cool out. So I promised her that after Star Wars, every year we'd take 2 vacations, 2 to 3 weeks each year. That lasted for 1 year. Now I try to get in 1 vacation a year for a week or so. It always comes down to saying, next week, just let me get past this thing. By the time you get past this thing, there's always something else and you can't leave. Now, 1983 is my goal. I intend to take off for a year, if I can, and just not do anything. And that is why I'm not planning any other projects.
By May 1983, on the eve of the release of Return of the Jedi, he seemed more miserable than ever, as he told Denise Worrell.
It's hard to describe the amount of detail, the amount of work involved in making a film. It's a 3-year deadline with 2 years of really concentrated, serious work, 10 to 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. There are periods of 4 or 5 months in those years during shooting when the work is 16 to 18 hours a day. You get not much more than 5 hours of sleep a night, and that's hard. On Sunday, you're wiped out, and you're still thinking about the movie. People usually don't understand the implications of what I'm saying, living this way, day after day, but it's awesome. You can do it for a couple of months, but year after year, it gets to be grim. I've been doing it for God knows how long. It's more and more pressure, and I'm more and more unhappy, and tired, and exhausted, and dragging home endless problems at the end of the day. I'm not having that much fun. It's all work. It's very anxiety-ridden, very hard, very frustrating and relentless. The extent to which one's personal life is usurped cannot be overestimated. It has made me less of a happy person than I think I could be. It has disrupted my family life. I have a wife and a 2-year-old daughter, and they are the most important things in my life. My family is it for me. Amanda's 2 years old now, and she's magic. She's this little girl, and she ain't going to wait for me. She's going. She's growing. The last thing in the world I want is to turn around and have her be 18 and say, "Hi, Dad, where have you been all my life?"
Dale Pollack's book, published in early 1983, offers some sad clues to the unhappy state of Lucas's marriage. In many instances, Marcia complains that George is always so busy that their personal life has become a struggle. And in a particularly sad moment, she reflects on how unhappy their wealth has ultimately made her. An unpretentious woman used to living in small homes, she now is faced with a mansion so big that she had to depend on maids to clean it. She used to resent her rich friends when she was young, but now she wears a large diamond ring and does her errands in a Mercedes-Benz. For such a humble couple, coping with their fame was equally difficult for both of them. "I think some of the striving has been taken out of my life," she said quietly. "I was a great achiever, a self-made girl who started from nothing and worked hard and got rewarded. In a way, I regret having all those obstacles removed." Perhaps the most telling sign of the state of their marriage comes from Marcia's observation of their current life. Getting here was a lot more fun than being here. George and Marcia had just adopted a baby girl, Amanda, in 1981. Adoption was a necessity due to the fact that George himself was diagnosed with infertility. Having been married since 1969, Marcia had wanted to slow down and start a family ever since then. Their life had begun to grow out of control with the mega success bestowed upon them in the last half decade, and with Lucas sworn to have dictatorial control over his expanding empire and its films, there was little time left to enjoy real life. "For me, the bottom line was just that he was all work and no play," Marcia told Peter Biskind in 1997. Their relationship had become strained, but it seemed they had made it through the worst of it and could finally resume their lives. But sadly, shortly after Pollack's book was published, and only weeks after the final Star Wars film opened, with Lucas hoping to finally be able to give his family more attention now that his saga was finished, the Lucases took a turn for the worst. George and Marcia got divorced. As Lucas recalled with regret on the 2004 documentary Empire of Dreams,
The challenge is always trying to do something that is all-consuming with having a private life. And I had made the decision after Star Wars that I had certain goals in my private life. One was to be independent of Hollywood. The other one, ultimately, was to have a family. I finished Return of the Jedi. I figured that was the end of it for me. I figured that, well, I've done it. I've finished my trilogy. This is what I started out to do. This is what I was determined to get finished. And it was overwhelming and difficult, but fate has a way of stepping in. I ended up getting divorced right as the film Jedi was finished, and I was left to raise my daughter.
Early in June 1983, Lucas called his staff into his office, and as he and Marcia held hands, he informed them that they were divorcing after 15 years of marriage. His staff stared back in shock. The news was made public shortly after. Just as it seemed that a new horizon was looming, Lucas's life suddenly came crashing down, his marriage unable to sustain itself to the completion of the film, and the icy tension that had existed beneath the quaint exterior of their relationship finally bubbled up in all its ugliness. Richard Walter saw the Lucases at a party at Randall Kleiser's house just before the divorce and recalled to John Baxter, "I ended up in the corner with Marcia, chatting with her, and what she told me underscored a sense I'd always had that intimacy was not a gigantic part of George's life. She just sort of blurted it out that it was extremely isolating. It was like Fortress Lucas. I'd heard this from people who worked with him at the time. They would say, 'I can't stand it. He's brilliant, but it's so cold. I feel like I'm suffocating. I've got to get out of here.' Marcia told me she just couldn't stand the darkness any longer. Although he planned on semi-retiring to be with his wife and daughter, it was too little too late. The emotional distance between them had been festering for some time, and in George's absence, Marcia had already fallen in love with another man. With George off shooting Return of the Jedi, Lucas turned supervising the still-under-construction Skywalker Ranch to Marcia. The beautiful library was garnished with a stunning stained-glass domed roof, which was designed by an artist named Tom Rodriguez. Marcia began seeing him. Marcia's subsequent disappearance from Hollywood has left the event shrouded in much mystery, but she revealed her side of the story in a rare interview for Peter Biskin's book Easy Riders, Raging Bulls. "I felt that we had paid our dues, fought our battles, worked 8 days a week, 25 hours a day. I wanted to stop and smell the flowers. I wanted joy in my life, and George just didn't. He was very emotionally blocked, incapable of sharing feelings. He wanted to stay on that workaholic track, the empire builder, the dynamo, and I couldn't see myself living that way for the rest of my life. I felt we were partners, partners in the ranch, partners in our home, and we did these films together. It wasn't a 50% partner, but I felt I had something to bring to the table. I was the more emotional person who came from the heart, and George was the more intellectual and visual, and I thought that provided a nice balance. But George would never acknowledge that to me. I think he resented my criticisms, felt that all I ever did was put him down. In his mind, I always stayed the stupid valley girl. He never felt I had any talent. He never felt I was very smart, and he never gave me much credit. When we were finishing Jedi, George told me he thought I was a pretty good editor. In the 16 years of our being together, I think that was the only time he complimented me." The divorce was significant not just for Lucas, but for his films. Marcia had long been regarded as George's secret weapon. Throughout the writing, shooting, and editing of all his films, she would be there with him, giving him advice and keeping him down to earth when no one else would or could. George Lucas met Marcia Griffin while on his first real job, working for legendary film editor Verna Fields. With an overflow of footage coming in, Fields needed a professional editor to help in the workload and hired Marcia. Because she was already a professional, Fields paired her up with the just-graduated film student, Lucas. The two were somewhat a pair of opposites, he calm and introverted, while she feisty and social. Lucas's friends recall meeting her. She was a knockout, John Milius told Dale Pollack. We all wondered how little George got this great-looking girl, and smart, too, obsessed with films. And she was a better editor than he was. John Plummer couldn't quite figure out how someone as reserved as George was going with such a strong-willed dynamo. Marcia said, he's got a very childish, silly, fun side. But he doesn't even like me to talk about that because he is so intensely private. As a woman working in the film industry in the 1960s, she had to be strong-willed. Having come from a poor family, she was a self-made woman.
Marcia and I got along real well, Lucas noted to Pollack. We were both feisty, and neither one of us would take any shit from the other. I sort of liked that. I didn't like someone who could be run over.
Marcia was a constant source of strength and encouragement for Lucas, and one of his strongest assets, though she was critical of both THX-1138 and Star Wars, illustrating the fundamental aesthetic differences between herself and her husband. During the making of Star Wars, when many others dismissed the bizarre and hard-to-understand film, Marcia was one of the few who offered him useful criticism. Pollack reported, Marcia's faith never wavered. She was at once George's most severe critic and most ardent supporter. She wasn't afraid to say she didn't understand something in Star Wars, or to point out the sections that bored her. Lucas got angry, but he knew Marcia was articulating his own suspicions. I'm real hard, Marcia says, but I only tell him what he already knows. She was also the only person to whom Lucas could vent his frustration. A marriage where both people are in the same business and both are very strong is a challenge. You've got to go through a lot of changes, says George. Marcia's suggestions were among the few Lucas took seriously. Pollack described how Marcia's contributions complemented Lucas's weaknesses. George had a secret weapon in Marcia. Like every director who has worked with her, Spielberg thinks she has an excellent eye. Marcia is indispensable to Lucas because she compensates for his deficiencies. Where George is not unduly concerned with character and lacks faith in an audience's patience, Marcia figures out how a movie can be made warmer, how the characters can be given depth and resonance. George's mother Dorothy remembered with fondness. Marcia spoiled George terribly when he was making films. She'd bring him breakfast in bed after the nights he worked late. I have an innate ability to take good material and make it better, and to take fair material and make it good, Marcia said in Skywalking. I think I'm even an editor in real life. On the business front, she was pivotal in the creation of Lucasfilm and Skywalker Ranch, which she also managed while Lucas was shooting Return of the Jedi. Pollack also made note of an amusing incident involving the ending of Raiders of the Lost Ark. Marcia was instrumental in changing the ending of Raiders, in which Indiana delivers the Ark to Washington. Marion is nowhere to be seen, presumably stranded on an island with a submarine and a lot of melted Nazis. Marcia watched the rough cut in silence and then leveled the boom. She said there was no emotional resolution to the ending because the girl disappears. Everyone was feeling really good until she said that, Dunham recalls. It was one of those, oh no, we lost sight of that. Spielberg reshot the scene in downtown San Francisco, having Marion wait for Indiana on the steps on the government building. Marcia, once again, had come to the rescue. Mark Hamill remembered her being a severely underestimated influence in her husband's films, and whom was responsible for providing their warmth and emotion. You can see a huge difference in the films that he does now and the films that he did when he was married. I know for a fact that Marcia Lucas was responsible for convincing him to keep that little kiss for luck before Carrie Fisher and I swing across the chasm in the first film. Oh, I don't like it. People laugh in the previews. And she said, George, they're laughing because it's so sweet and unexpected. And her influence was such that if she wanted to keep it, it was in. When the little mouse robot comes up when Harrison and I are delivering Chewbacca to the prison and he roars at it and it screams sort of and runs away, George wanted to cut that and Marcia insisted that he keep it. She was really the warmth in the heart of those films, a good person he could talk to, bounce ideas off of. Clearly, Marcia was a pivotal player, not only in Lucas's life, but in his films. Her departure from him would be felt in the cinema that followed. Perhaps just as sadly for her, Return of the Jedi would be her last credit as editor. The split was heartbreaking for Lucas, and probably for Marcia, too. In the 10 years since American Graffiti catapulted her husband to success, their marriage had slowly but surely eroded, especially in the last 7 years in which Lucasfilm ruled George's life. Some of their friends were unsurprised by the split, such as Rhonda Gomez and Howard Zeef. "He just didn't want to have fun," Gomez said to author Peter Biskind. "Marcia wanted to go to Europe and see things. George wanted to stay in the hotel room and have his TV dinners." In interviews, Lucas would tell how his wife wanted to be able to go to restaurants and be like normal couples. But the onslaught of success threw a roadblock of work in front of him and left the empire of Lucasfilm forever separating the two. Marcia had wanted to have children since the 1970s, and after Star Wars was filmed, they tried to conceive, but were unable to because of George's infertility. However, after Star Wars was released, they did not immediately adopt. With the success of Star Wars bringing him so many opportunities, George knew his work would keep him so busy that he would not be able to make the films and raise a family at the same time. He had to choose between Star Wars and family, and he chose Star Wars. His window of opportunity to make these blockbusters may have been finite, and celebrities come and go with the regularity of tide changes. The amount of profit the films would bring him would set him up for life, and Lucas could settle down then instead.
"I was desperate to have a family," he recalled in 1983, just before the divorce would hit. "Yet I knew when I had a family, I couldn't devote 98% of my time to the company. Since my daughter, the focus has changed."
Marcia pressured him into eventually settling for a compromise. They finally adopted in 1981, after Lucas decided to be done with the saga.
"I love Star Wars," he said in 1983. "I think it's great, but I just don't want to sacrifice my entire life for it. I don't want to be an all-consumed workaholic. I want to enjoy the better things in life like a normal person. Just, say, go out and stand on a hill and enjoy life."
For 2 brief years, Lucas had this one and only window into a normal life that could have been. He had a beautiful, brilliant wife and a wonderful daughter, and for once he was doing his best to enjoy such happiness. "I make everyone leave at 6 o'clock so that when George comes home, it's just the two of us and Amanda," Marcia said at the time. "Now that we have Amanda, we actually have dinner at the table. I cook, I do the dishes, and we give Amanda a bath together. George sometimes feeds her a bottle in the TV room. We just decided to try to keep our lives as normal as possible." But it was not to last. The three were seldom together, and although they tried to mend things at the very end, it was not enough to close the wounds in their relationship that were already opened. Towards the end of their marriage, Marcia suggested they see a marriage counselor, but George refused the idea, an attitude Peter Biskind surmises was likely picked up from his small-town father. She later suggested a trial separation, but he rejected that as well and begged her to wait until the last Star Wars film was done. "I know he wanted me to stay, but it was just too little too late," Marcia said. Walter Murch offered his view of the collapse to Biskind, saying,
"I think what Marcia saw was that his success was winding him tighter and tighter into a workaholic, control-driven person, and she thought that this was destructive, which it probably is in the long run."
Lucas's obsession with Skywalker Ranch turned him into a distant workaholic, as he channeled all his time and energy into the Star Wars series in order to realize the facility, gambling away all of their fortune. But Lucas knew that with Return of the Jedi, the dream would finally be complete. But Marcia could care less about Skywalker Ranch. She was happy with just being a regular union editor, and George was maintaining that all he wanted to do was make experimental films. THX-1138 was made on a shoestring budget and edited in the attic of their home, and nothing was stopping him from doing this again. She wanted to enjoy life, And being millionaires, they had the unimaginable chance to do so in luxury, to not have to worry about the future after having lived on the edge of poverty for so many years. Lucas was simply too wrapped up in his own empire building to see his private life disintegrating around him.
"Marcia complains that I either live in the past or in the future, but never in the present,"
Lucas once remarked to Dale Pollack after a day's work filming Return of the Jedi.
"In a way, she's right. I'm always thinking about what's going to happen or what has happened. I think when I finish this film, I'll be able to live in the present. Maybe."
The release of Return of the Jedi would be bittersweet for Lucas. The Worst of Times. Anticipation for the film was incredible, and the film broke all opening records at theaters. But nevertheless, the film was met with some harsh criticism. Whereas Star Wars had been showered in praise, Empire Strikes Back had its share of detractors, but none were as bad as the backlash Return of the Jedi endured. For the first time, one of Lucas's films was regarded as a disappointment. Gene Siskel complained it lacked the humanity and richly drawn characters that brighten Star Wars, while Newsweek proclaimed, "Jedi is downright repetitive." And the New York Times wrote, "The old Star Wars gang are back, doing what they've done before, but this time with a certain evident boredom." The use of cute and cuddly Ewoks was heavily criticized as being an obvious merchandising ploy, while many also noted that the characters and dialogue lacked the sharp wit or compelling depth of the previous two films. Nonetheless, the film was still received well by many, even if it had unfavorable reviews. "Return of the Jedi is fun, magnificent fun," Roger Ebert wrote in the Chicago Sun-Times. "The movie is a complete entertainment, a feast for the eyes and a delight for the fancy." It's a little amazing how Lucas and his associates keep topping themselves. The film would go on to gross over $260 million domestically. For Lucas, things were not so celebratory. His separation and impending divorce left him shattered and in a state of emotional depression, and with a bitter ending to his space saga. And although the divorce left a hole in Lucas's heart, it left a bigger one in his wallet. As Lucasfilm president Bob Greber noted to Dale Pollack in 1983, "People sometimes forget that Marcia Lucas owns half of this company and is a very important part of it." In the divorce settlement, Lucas lost much of his fortune, as much as $50 million, according to Peter Biskin's reports. His riches from the success of the Star Wars films were suddenly taken from him. With Marcia playing such a prominent role in both Lucasfilm and the three Star Wars films, she was entitled to her share of it. Custody of their daughter was split between them, but it was decided that George would care for her. Marcia was said to visit occasionally, but this quickly tapered off to the point where they hardly saw each other. Marcia and Tom Rodriguez had already bought a house in the San Francisco suburb of Belvedere, and she quickly became pregnant with her first natural daughter, Amy. Emotionally, Lucas was a wreck, and financially, he was in an equally ruinous position. After all the struggles Lucas had made to film the Star Wars trilogy, the sacrifice that was supposed to grant him his personal and financial freedom, his reward for it was heartbreak, plunder, and desertion. His position as empire builder had not only pushed away his wife, but his friends as well. He had an infamous falling out with Francis Coppola at the start of the decade, due to many things, such as Coppola having abandoned San Francisco and moved Zoetrope back to Los Angeles. Coppola, on the other hand, descended into personal ruin, resented Lucas for not saving him from bankruptcy after Lucas refused to loan him a few million dollars to pay off his debts. Lucas replies his money was tied up with Empire Strikes Back. "When he got divorced, George came to me and wanted to be my friend," Coppola recalled to Peter Biskind. "He apologized." Many of his film school friends were seldom seen anymore as well. After all was said and done, Lucas was left only with his crumbling empire, from which to rule from his lonely throne. And it wasn't just him. All the major players of the American New Wave were falling simultaneously. Coppola was bankrupt and ruined, and Scorsese had made a series of disasters. Even Spielberg's marriage was about to implode, leading to an infamous $100 million settlement. And the careers and personal lives of major players like Peter Bogdanovich, Paul Schrader, and William Friedkin went into nosedives. Independent and personal films were failing at the box office, which was again being dominated by studio-controlled pictures. By 1983, the glory days of the 70s would be dead and buried. Lucas's destruction was a representation of his entire era. Lucas looked back on the tragedy 16 years later in an interview with Leslie Stahl for 60 Minutes. Lucas:
"It was very hard. The divorce kind of destroyed me. It did take me a couple of years to sort of unwind myself and come out of it."
Leslie Stahl: "You didn't see it coming?"
"Oh, no, I didn't."
"You were happy, everything was fine, and there was another man, and you didn't know."
10 years younger than I was. It was one of those classic divorce situations.
Lucas's close friend Steven Spielberg, whom Lucas would be working with on the Raiders sequel as the divorce was occurring, remembered the time in an interview with 60 Minutes. "The divorce pulverized him. George and Marcia, for me, were the reason you got married, because it was insurance policy that marriages do work, and it working together and living together, and having understandings on many, many different planes, it does work. And when it didn't work, and when that marriage didn't work, I lost my faith in marriage for a long time." Marcia took her half of the companies and left. She had no interest in a corporate empire, and gladly took her financial share in cash so that she could settle down with her new family. But Lucas remained with the corporation, determined to rebuild himself. Just as he had finally earned his freedom from Hollywood, to be financially secure enough to never have to be involved with a movie studio again, the dream unexpectedly crumbled. It would be over 2 decades before he would be able to climb back to this position. His dream of Skywalker Ranch also collapsed. At first thought to be a communal filmmaking Xanadu, its unusual location far, far away from Hollywood led to it essentially being forgotten and deserted. Its facilities were so state-of-the-art and expensive that none but the biggest Hollywood blockbusters could use it. Exactly the type of productions that Lucas claimed the facility was built to dethrone. Its lavish library, the one garnished with that infamous domed stained glass roof, went virtually unused, and no indie filmmaking paradise ever sprouted. In the end, Skywalker Ranch turned into the $20 million Lucasfilm office, and from it ruled George Lucas, alone and without purpose.
Treading Water. Lucas may not have had the lucrative riches that he once did, but he did have a ready source of income at his disposal. ILM had grown to become the leading special effects house in the world, achieving Academy Award-winning work on Poltergeist, Star Trek II, and E.T. the Extraterrestrial, and had become a significant financial asset for Lucas, all the while leading the forefront in technological development. Lucasfilm, meanwhile, had a source of income far greater than the Star Wars films themselves, the merchandising based on them. Star Wars had revolutionized the marketing of movies. Lucas promoted the films with toys, action figures, books, clothing, and any sort of product imaginable, from Pez dispensers to underoos to coloring books. At the time Lucas had negotiated his contract with Fox, merchandising in movies was not seen as profitable. Star Wars would change this forever. Lucas was able to retain merchandising rights in exchange for a pay cut, and as a result, received the main source of funding for his empire. Action figures continued to sell, though with the series over, not nearly as well. And with the explosion of video games in the mid-80s, LucasArts would be created to cater to this market, with interactive software for home computers and video game systems. Television would also prove a valuable asset in continuing expansion of Lucasfilm. First, there would be a made-for-television movie called The Ewok Adventure, a live-action spin-off designed for children. Lucas once described it as a gift for his daughter. The plot concerned Wicket and his Ewok friends, helping two children find their parents after their ship crash lands on Endor. The film featured the first appearance of the name Mace, a name from Lucas's early Star Wars notes, and which would be later used in the prequels. After the first Ewok movie in 1984, there would be another made-for-television film in 1986, this one concerning a tyrant and a witch trying to attack the Ewok villages. The film was titled Ewoks: The Battle for Endor. In a familiar move, the previous film was retitled to match it, now known as Ewoks: The Caravan of Courage. Not one, but two animated Star Wars spin-offs would be created for Saturday morning programming in 1985. The first was Ewoks, hot on the trail of the TV movie, featuring Wicket and the Ewoks in episodes set before Return of the Jedi. The second was Droids, featuring the adventures of R2-D2 and C-3PO before they joined Luke. Merchandise was, of course, produced for all of these spin-offs. More ambitiously, Lucasfilm teamed up with Disney, first in 1986, to produce a Michael Jackson 3D sci-fi film called Captain EO for Disneyland, directed by Francis Coppola, and then a Star Wars theme park ride, which opened to much success in 1987 as Disneyland's Star Tours. The Lucasfilm products and corporate diversification would become the key to rebuilding the empire. Lucas no longer had enough money to self-finance another film, as he had done in the past. Just as well, he no longer had the desire to. When Return of the Jedi was nearing completion, Lucas remarked how he would like to return to making the abstract, arthouse-type films he had dreamed of in his youth, when he first moved to San Francisco with Marcia, as Dale Pollack reported in 1983. Lucas wants to rediscover the virtues of being an amateur. He has wanted to make esoteric movies like THX since he left USC. Now he has the time and money to do it. He's determined to make films that are abstract and emotional, without plot or characters. He won't talk about specific ideas. He seems unsure exactly what he wants to do. But it's clear that these impressionistic works are the complete opposite of his professional films. Whatever Lucas finds with his experimental films, he'll probably keep to himself. If they don't work, I'm certainly not going to show them to anybody. If they do work, they'll probably get a very limited release. Lucas had been talking about making these experimental personal films since the 1970s, as far back as a 1974 interview with Film Quarterly magazine following the release of the commercial American Graffiti. And well after the millennium, he would still be talking about one day soon making these films. As of 2008, he is not yet. Like his infamous "That's the way it always was" statements, these may be observed as more examples of his security blanket. After American Graffiti and Star Wars became huge mainstream blockbusters associated with Hollywood, the success of which is credited with killing off the personal films of the American New Wave, Lucas would be quick to remind listeners that he was really an experimental arthouse type, and that the whole mainstream thing was accidental. As if uncomfortable with being such a mainstream blockbuster maker, declaring that he will be making experimental personal films that are destined to fail may be his way of coping with such fame. In 1974, he vowed to make such films after Star Wars. In 1978, he vowed to make such films after the Star Wars trilogy. In 1983, he vowed to make such things in the near future. In 2005, he vowed to make such things now that he was done with Star Wars, again. Now, in 2008, he has vowed to make such things after the Star Wars television series is complete, sometime close to 2010. Coppola is famous for once having remarked, "Star Wars robbed America of one of its most challenging filmmakers." But it was a choice Lucas made on his own. In fact, Marcia Lucas seems perplexed by Lucas's inability to return to the field. As she told Peter Biskind, By the time George could afford to have a film facility, he no longer wanted to direct. After Star Wars, he insisted, "I'm never going to direct another establishment-type movie again." I used to say, for someone who wants to be an experimental filmmaker, why are you spending this fortune on a facility to make Hollywood movies? We edited THX in our attic. We edited American Graffiti over Francis's garage. I just don't get it, George. The Lucasfilm empire, the computer division, ILM, the licensing and lawyers, seemed to me to be this inverted triangle sitting on a P, which was the Star Wars trilogy. But he wasn't going to make any more Star Wars, and the P was going to dry up and crumble, and then he was going to be left with this huge facility with its enormous overhead. And why did he want to do that if he wasn't going to make movies? I still don't get it. Indeed, such actions seem to fly in the face of the philosophy he espouses. Nonetheless, by the mid-80s, it seemed Lucas had resigned to the life of a businessman.
One of the great losses is that Marcia never became a filmmaker and continued as an editor, John Milius mused in Mythmaker. But one of the other great losses is that George stopped making movies, and he got interested in the sort of stuff that Lucasfilm puts out. Because he was a really dynamic filmmaker.
In the aftermath of his divorce, Lucas was left with nothing but his companies and his daughter, Amanda. She was the only remnant from his happier life, and Lucas focused all of his attention on raising her as a single father, one who was as devoted as a parent could be. Trying to rebound from his divorce, Lucas was in a relationship with singer Linda Ronstadt starting in 1984, which apparently went as serious as an engagement ring. But somehow the relationship would fizzle out. Afterwards, Lucas apparently decided he didn't need a wife to have a family. He would adopt another daughter, Katie, and finally a son, Jet. He has never remarried and would remain dedicated solely to his kids and his companies. Lucas speaks with 60 Minutes in 1999. Leslie Stahl. Did the divorce hurt you so badly that that's going to be it for marriage, you think? Lucas.
Well, I don't know. I fell in love a couple of years later after that. I fell in love with another woman.
Linda Ronstadt?
Yeah, but she was somebody who just didn't want to get married. And eventually I wanted to get married. And I think as you get older, and as you get burned a few times, you either get wearier or wiser. I don't know which. I guess I'm wearier and wiser and older. And I have a big life, and I have three kids.
Lucasfilm was since making a slow but consistent recovery from Lucas's divorce. It had since spawned many smaller sub-companies, and its computer division, headed by Pixar, had become a pioneer in the digital arts. EditDroid became the first non-linear editing system, eventually becoming the industry standard Avid, while ILM continued to grow exponentially, becoming the first company to fully integrate CGI into a film, i.e., young Sherlock Holmes. In 1986, Lucas would sell Pixar to Apple Computer co-founder Steve Jobs for $10 million, giving Lucasfilm a needed shot of capital. Marcia, meanwhile, was slowly fading from the film community and from Lucas's life. He was very bitter and vindictive about the divorce, Marcia remembered in Peter Biskin's book. Francis and Ellie Coppola used to have an Easter party out in Napa, and the first couple of years after the divorce, I used to get to see everyone. The Barwoods, the Robbinses, and then I stopped being invited. Years later, I ran into Ellie down in L.A., and she said, "I always wanted to call you to explain that when Francis and George were working on Tucker, George asked him not to invite you, because he was very uncomfortable around you. That really hurt. It's not enough that I'm erased from his life. He wants to blackball me, too, with people who were my friends. It's like I never existed." In the meantime, Lucas was enjoying a casual life of executive overseer, easily managing his companies while caring for his children. Since his divorce, the sequel to Raiders of the Lost Ark, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, was the only major film involvement he had. In fact, the story was written by him in the bitter shadow of his divorce trial, lending the film a dark and violent tone that led to the creation of the PG-13 rating in the United States. The film was popular among audiences, but heavily criticized by critics and parents. His only other efforts in cinema came when he occasionally helped his friends by executive producing their films. Walter Murch's Return to Oz, which Lucas bailed out of serious debt at the hands of producer Gary Kurtz, which would prove to be an interesting but expensive bomb. Willard Hike's Howard the Duck, based off the popular comic book, an embarrassing disaster that would be virtually disowned by all, though Lucas's creative involvement is often exaggerated. Francis Ford Coppola's Tucker, The Man and His Dreams, which would also have a disappointing release, Jim Henson's Labyrinth, another bomb, and Steven Spielberg's animated hit The Land Before Time, among others. Willow marked Lucas's return to the industry in a more active role in 1988, when he conceived and produced the Ron Howard film, with a story that combined equal parts of Lord of the Rings and Star Wars. It too had a disappointing release, though it has since become an 80s favorite. A third Indiana Jones film would be made shortly after, which he again produced with Spielberg at the helm, and was one of 1989's biggest hits, perhaps making up for some of the financially unsuccessful cinema ventures Lucas had taken that decade. Lucas explained to The Hollywood Reporter,
"I had the 20-year gap because I finished 1983's Return of the Jedi, and I had a daughter. I had just gotten divorced, and I was raising my daughter, and I felt that was the most important thing, and I was going to spend my time raising her. Then I adopted other children and spent 15 years raising them. At the same time, there was another aspect to it. Because of the divorce, Lucasfilm was in difficult financial straits. To straighten out the company and get it solid without Star Wars, without me producing product for them, I basically ended up getting a job where I could go to work at 10 or 11 a.m. and come home at 4 or 5 p.m.
But what was happening with Star Wars while all of this was occurring? Lucas had lapsed into semi-retirement, and it did not seem as if Star Wars was on the radar at all. In 1983, he had claimed to want to never make another Star Wars film again.
"I am afraid that if I did another Star Wars movie now, I'd be straying from my path," Lucas said in May 1983. "To me, that would be like being seduced by the dark side. But more than anything else, I think I'd be unhappy."
Fans patiently waited, fed on Lucas's claims that after Return of the Jedi, there would be a prequel trilogy, followed by a sequel trilogy. Since he had made those claims, much in his life had changed. The sequel trilogy had all but evaporated. Lucas publicly speculated that perhaps a trilogy detailing post-Return of the Jedi stories could be written later, with the aged cast of the originals returning. But this did not seem very likely at all, although Lucas would not admit this for over a decade. The prequel trilogy remained in Lucas's mind as a possible storyline, however, though at that time he had no desire to make them. But he genuinely liked the story, and had sketched out a fairly elaborate plot over the years, refining the details and characters as they changed throughout the process of writing the original trilogy. The prequels would also be much more complex than the second trilogy, and of a more sophisticated nature, with heavy political plotting and tragic betrayal afoot. As was described by Time magazine in 1983, "The films that record what went on in the beginning, if they are ever made, will be altogether different in look and tone from the existing trilogy," says Lucas. "They will be more melodramatic, showing the political intrigue and Machiavellian plotting that led to the downfall of the once noble republic. They will have only enough outward action to keep the plot moving. Obi-Wan Kenobi, the elder Jedi played by Alec Guinness in the Star Wars series, and Darth Vader will be seen as younger men, while Luke Skywalker will make a brief appearance as a baby in Episode 3. The outline he had developed since 1977 was vague, giving only the major plot revelations. and was under a dozen pages long, according to Lucas. The story would be about Obi-Wan Kenobi, a Jedi in the final days of the Old Republic, who recruits and trains a brilliant prodigy named Anakin Skywalker. At the same time, a devious politician and secret Dark Lord named Palpatine schemes his way into office, manipulating the people and proclaiming himself Emperor. He lures young Skywalker to the dark side and turns him against his fellow Jedi Knights, laying a trap where the Jedi are all but wiped out. Obi-Wan confronts his student to turn him away from the dark side, but a battle ensues on the edge of a volcano, and Obi-Wan defeats Skywalker, horribly burning him. The Emperor is able to salvage his dark apprentice before the boy is completely dead, and resurrects him as the bionic Darth Vader. Meanwhile, Obi-Wan aids Skywalker's wife in escaping with her secret children. Luke is taken to Tatooine, to live with Obi-Wan's brother, where Obi-Wan also remains in exile, while Leia is taken to Alderaan, to live with Senator Bail Organa. Darth Vader, meanwhile, has become the right hand of the Emperor, hunting down the remaining Jedi as the Empire engulfs the galaxy. During the course of the story, the Clone Wars would occur, which Kenobi and Anakin would fight in and become galactic heroes. C-3PO and R2-D2 would also be in the story somewhere, the only common elements throughout the entire saga. But with his children still young and his empire still expanding, Lucas lacked any desire to immediately return to either Star Wars or directing, as he told Rolling Stone in 1987.
"I'll do more Star Wars films eventually. I just don't know when. I've done a lot of research, but my heart is in other areas right now. I can make more Star Wars and make zillions of dollars, but I don't need to do that, and I really don't have the interest right now. There is a story there I would like to tell. It's just that it isn't beating in my head hard enough to say, I have to get this out of here. I'm more interested in other things." "Star Wars is sitting on the shelf, and I'm not under any pressure to do anything with it," he remarked during this period.
However, with more and more time passing since his last venture behind the camera, Lucas was beginning to get the itch to return to movie making.
"It will be unbelievably expensive," Lucas said of the new Star Wars trilogy at the 1989 opening of Disney MGM Studios. "And that's one of the things holding it up. If there was a way of doing them less expensively, it could make it easier to go ahead and do more. But there are just huge, huge amounts of money involved."
Lucas didn't have a bottomless pit of money, especially after his divorce, which he had only begun to recover from at that point, which is another prime reason for the wait. It wouldn't be until the 1990s that Lucas had regained enough wealth to personally fund a blockbuster film, and he wasn't interested in placing the franchise in the hands of a studio. As the 1990s came about, Lucas continued to sit on his prequel story, but realized that if he were to make it at all, it would have to be soon. Huge strides were being made by ILM in computer graphics technology. James Cameron's The Abyss and Terminator 2 made great leaps in the field, offering photorealistic creatures integrated into live action, although they were simple and crude. A water tentacle and a similar-looking liquid metal shapeshifter. Still, Lucas knew that the complex prequel trilogy would require more advancements than that for the fantastic vision he was interested in portraying. But it was clear that the technology was rapidly approaching that would allow him to make truly imaginative films, no longer bound by simple puppets, models, and matte paintings. That day would come sooner than anyone realized. Around the same time, Star Wars was about to undergo a sort of renaissance. The trilogy had since slumped into decline, with no new toys having been manufactured since the mid-80s. And with the advent of home video, no theatrical re-releases, save for a very limited and seldom remembered 1985 triple bill. A new generation had since been born, one that had never experienced the original releases firsthand, but grew up weaned on television and home video incarnations of the saga. In fact, Star Wars was the first video cassette to make $1 million in rentals. The films had been parodied in the 1987 film Spaceballs, but as reviewers of the time pointed out, by then even a satire of the trilogy was out of date. The mass-produced toys and merchandise soon became unpopular and found their way into second-hand stores and garage sales. As kids embraced the latest trends, such as the new Transformers and My Little Pony toy lines, each with their own popular television cartoons. West End Games had produced Star Wars role-playing games, but those catered to a very small, hardcore sci-fi fanbase. In winter 1987, Banthatrax and the official Star Wars fan club closed down, with a written promise from George Lucas in one of the final issues that the club would be reactivated once more Star Wars films were made. However, even as Star Wars slowly began to disappear from contemporary culture and move into the realm of classic, the original film was inaugurated into the Library of Congress's National Film Registry in 1989. A loyal yet invisible following, spanning all ages, quietly lay in wait for the coming years when Star Wars would return. Star Wars was thought to be dead, but in reality, it was only in hibernation. Chapter 9. The Beginning, Again. In 1989, Bantam Publishing proposed to Lucasfilm that a new Star Wars book be commissioned. Novels which went beyond the films had been experimented with in the days of the original trilogy. Splinter of the Mind's Eye in 1978, a trilogy of Han Solo adventure novels from 1979 to 1980, and a Lando trilogy in 1983. But no new developments had been made in the Star Wars universe since then, aside from the once popular Marvel comic series, which had been put to rest in 1986. It took Lucasfilm over a year to reply to Bantam's proposal, when it was finally decided to make another Star Wars novel. Award-winning science fiction author Timothy Zahn was contacted. Zahn recalled in 1992, "Well, I understand that Lou Aronica, the publisher of Bantam Spectra, contacted Lucasfilm about 3 years ago to suggest a new Star Wars book. He didn't hear back from them for about a year. Then they said, 'Yes, this sounds interesting, let's talk.' Aronica and his editors assembled a list of potential writers, and I guess I was the first one they asked. I took the job." It seems, in that waiting period, Lucas had finally decided that the sequel trilogy was a no-go. The closest he could ever come was to continue the saga as novels, a concept he himself had first implemented with Alan Dean Foster in 1975, and here awaited the perfect opportunity. He told Wired,
"The sequels were never really going to get made anyway, unlike 1, 2, and 3, where the stories have existed for 20 years. The idea of 7, 8, and 9 actually came from people asking me about sequels. And I said, I don't know, maybe someday. Then, when the licensing people came and asked, 'Can we do novels?' I said, 'Do sequels, because I'll probably never do sequels.'"
Timothy Zahn would eventually compose a trilogy, and it seems as if it was the sequel trilogy that never was. The story would feature a character similar to the abandoned Jedi sister concept from the original sequel plots of 1977, Mara Jade, as well as ample substitutes for Vader and the Emperor, in Dark Jedi Joris Sebowith and Grand Admiral Thrawn. Had Abaddon, the planet-wide metropolis from the early drafts of Return of the Jedi, would be resurrected as well, now renamed Coruscant. And the story would revolve around the rebuilding of the Republic, as Lucas had stated for his own sequel trilogy. Although Zahn was given ample freedom to construct the story as he wished, Lucas himself would be more involved in the writing than any of the subsequent novels, the volume of which would later grow far beyond his control. For Zahn's sequel trilogy, Lucas would personally read and approve the treatments, and have veto power in story development. His first rule? The story is set shortly after the events of Return of the Jedi. Zahn said in 1991, "My original instructions from LucasArts consisted of exactly two rules. The books were to start 3 to 5 years after Return of the Jedi, and I couldn't use anyone who'd been explicitly killed off in the movies. Aside from that, I was given essentially a blank check to do what I wanted." A couple of other rules came in later after I'd submitted my outline, but they required only minor changes in the story itself. LucasArts has complete veto power over everything I do, of course, but so far they've allowed me pretty much a free hand. Which is not to say they're not keeping close watch on what I'm doing. They are. George Lucas did read the original outline. Zahn talked about the process of negotiating the plot with Lucasfilm in this early interview. "They looked at the outline and told me a couple of things I couldn't do. They cut out my favorite character. And originally, Joris Saboeth was going to be a clone of Obi-Wan Kenobi, but they said no. They didn't want me to refer in detail to the Clone Wars, which took place before the movies began. I guess by that time, Lucas had decided he was going to go back and make the prequel movies, and they didn't want me treading on his turf. But I got my way on most of it, and conceded on the things they simply didn't want me to do. So aside from relatively minor things, I had pretty much of a free hand. I was a couple of months into writing when they suddenly decided they wanted me to coordinate with the West End Games role-playing materials, too. They filled in a bunch of the gaps that I hadn't gotten around to filling in. The fact that the trilogy would have the Star Wars brand name on it guaranteed it some success. But the Star Wars series had disappeared from the limelight and was only popular with its devout fans." Zahn reminisced about the issue in an interview with Echostation.com. "Back when you were writing the first novel, did you ever question what you were doing? Did you ever stop and say to yourself, 'Why am I doing this? No one likes Star Wars anymore. Who is going to read this book?'" Zahn: "You bet I wondered about the project at times. No one had any idea how well this was going to do out in the marketplace. Certainly the initial bookstore's reaction and orders indicated it would be only a mild success." By the time the first book was complete, it was 1991. The Gulf War was ending. Kids were enamored with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, while MC Hammer and Salt-N-Pepa ruled MTV, and Nirvana stood poised to unleash grunge rock upon the world. Moviegoers eagerly looked forward to the impending release of Terminator 2, while Silence of the Lambs and Thelma and Louise continued to draw Oscar buzz. Star Wars was thoroughly dead and buried. The first book of Timothy Zahn's trilogy was titled Heir to the Empire and was released on June 4, 1991, to success that was as shocking as Lucas's was in 1977. The first printing of 60,000 sold out in its first week in stores, and the novel immediately became a national bestseller. It won rave reviews from critics and fans alike, and stayed on the New York Times bestsellers list for 29 weeks. The message was clear. Star Wars was as popular as it ever was. This unexpected turn set in motion a new phase in Lucasfilm. The two sequels were released each subsequent year, with Dark Force Rising in 1992 and The Last Command in 1993. Before even the second book was released, plans were underway to totally revamp Star Wars into the new decade. More novels were quickly planned, and emerging comic book company Dark Horse launched many new series, all of which did outstanding sales. Dark Empire was the first, hot on the trails of Heir to the Empire in 1991, and told the stunning tale of Luke's fall to the dark side and subsequent redemption, in a story meant to parallel his father's, which Lucas also had some level of involvement with. Within a few years, there would be over a dozen Star Wars novels, expanding the story beyond the films, in works such as the Jedi Academy trilogy and the Truce at Bakura. And comic lines would spring up with equal frequency, from the ancient prehistory of Tales of the Jedi to the dogfights of Rogue Squadron. merchandising would slowly return to production. As the books and comics continued to be popular, new lines of Micro Machines playsets were launched, and reprintings of posters, the original novelizations, and the Art of Star Wars books became hot-selling items. Splinter of the Mind's Eye and the Han Solo Adventures were republished, and Dark Horse re-released the original Marvel comic line. Lucasfilm Magazine was revamped in 1995 to deal with the huge resurgence of Star Wars activity, and the once-struggling fan club magazine became a hot newsstand item as the Star Wars Insider. Topps launched a slew of trading card lines, as well as its own Star Wars Galaxy magazine. Star Wars Galaxy Collector was later launched as a dedicated collector's magazine. There was so much merchandise produced that it needed an entire bi-monthly magazine to keep track of it all. LucasArts, the software division, surged in size as it developed hugely successful video games, such as its acclaimed Super Star Wars series for the Super Nintendo, as well as its popular X-Wing flight simulator for the computer. The 1995 CD-ROM game Rebel Assault 2 featured live-action segments featuring David Prowse as Darth Vader, as well as original props and costumes, and was photographed by Gil Taylor, the director of photography of the original Star Wars. Artwork, posters, collectible mugs, models, T-shirts, and Pez dispensers were all sold once again, and Galoob was making $120 million a year from Star Wars toys. Perhaps most significant of all, Kenner relaunched its Star Wars action figure line in a revamped 90s version in 1995. Darth Vader was even seen battling the Energizer Bunny in a humorous 1995 commercial. Star Wars was back, big time. Perhaps because of all this, Lucas decided that he would make his prequel trilogy sooner rather than later.
When I went and decided that I would tell the backstory, it was a very difficult decision at the time,
Lucas later recalled.
I figured I was done with Star Wars. I didn't want to do Star Wars anymore.
But with the discovery of such a large audience and the emerging digital technologies of ILM, Lucas now had incentive. And with the added wealth this Star Wars renaissance had brought, the financial ability to independently make the films.
It technically became possible to do it, and I had this backstory. The backstory intrigued me, because it kind of turns the whole series on its head.
Throughout the 80s, Lucas had given vague promises that he would one day make the prequel trilogy, but these seemed somewhat empty, and by the 1990s, the three films had grown to the status of legend. Lucas's decision to take time to raise his children paid off, and he maintained a happy family. He adopted his first son and third child, Jet, around this time.
They wanted a brother, he said of his two daughters in his A&E biography. I wanted another daughter because the girls were so wonderful, but it's great to have someone that understands explosions.
Now that the 90s were on their way, things were beginning to change in his life. In 1992, Lucasfilm premiered The Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, a television series inspired by the opening sequence from Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, portraying the title character as a boy. The series utilized all of Lucas's resources, providing ILM with a fertile testing ground for emerging digital techniques. Crowd replication, set extension, wire removal, digital matte painting, and digital compositing techniques were developed and refined. And most importantly, at an inexpensive cost. It was here that Lucas proposed that the future of filmmaking would be a digital one, as he told American Cinematographer.
On the TV series, I was able to work in a much lower res medium. We were able to move things around much more quickly and cheaply, so I could use digital technology more often. I said I want to be able to do a couple hundred shots in every hour-long episode and still have a budget that's under $50,000. I wanted to be able to play with this stuff and see how it worked. In the end, we made 22 feature films in the space of 5 years, and we experimented with all kinds of things. Some things worked, some didn't. We learned a lot in the process, and that's what I'm using now.
The series was also significant because of those involved in its making, for it was here that the future of Star Wars would be found. The original trilogy was